allowable.
You've got two more out in the hall.
Okay. We have a number of folks here to speak on various bills, and so we'll kind of jump around a little bit. Okay. let's start with well, before I do that, okay, we have some amendments before I open the work session. We have some amendments on HGR 59 that I want to consider, and we need to suspend the rules to reconsider that bill, but I want to make sure everybody knows what the amendments are and is okay with them before we open the before we reopen that issue. So what I'd like you to do is take a look at HGR 59, the dash 2 amendments, A2. If you pull out the bill, you'll notice that these amendments address a couple of the concerns that we discussed last time this bill was up. What it does is it would make the paragraph subsection E read like this. May also be used by the Oregon State Police for the policing of public highways, roads, streets, and roadside rest areas, period. Delete the rest of the line and the next line. And then it would say revenues authorized to be used under this paragraph may be used only to increase the budget for the Oregon State Police in order to provide levels of service not authorized by the budget in effect on the effective date of this amendment.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
I'm not sure I have HGR 59 amendment.
They're right on top.
They're right on top.
A2.
Okay. Oh, I should have tapped it. Never mind.
Okay. So the effect of this amendment would be to limit the functions allowable to patrol activities and delete this extremely broad provision that says for the protection of the people of Oregon. And then it would also clarify that only new revenues would be permitted. In other words, this could not be used as a backfill for the entire state police budget. Everybody okay with that?
Yeah.
Okay, then I'll open a work session on HGR 59.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Williams.
Mr. Chair, I would move for suspension of the rules so that we may reconsider the vote by which this committee passed HGR 59.
Representative Williams moves to suspend the rules to reconsider the vote by which we passed HGR 59. Is there any discussion, any objection? Representative Rosenbaum?
No.
Objection. Okay. Then HGR 59 is once again before us.
Representative Rosenbaum? I just wanted to clarify something that came to my attention after our last hearing and see if this is accurate. You were talking about this change having been made in 1979, but is this the case? I'd read this in the paper, actually, and so I just wanted to make sure it may or may not be true that this was put to a vote of the people in 1992 and rejected.
Dick, do you know that?
I do not know.
Does anybody know that? Anybody in the audience? Captain Wilford, can you?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Merkley.
Representative Rosen, could you clarify what aspect of it was put to the vote of the people?
Well, I'm certainly not an authority on this. Perhaps this witness is set to tell us.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Captain Greg Williford, Director of the Uniform Branch of the Oregon State Police Patrol Services Division. There was a referral by the legislature in 1991 that went to the vote to return the patrol function back to the trust fund. It was also tied to some surcharges, increases in registration fees as well, and it was defeated.
Okay. But it wasn't something that's as narrow as this game proposal.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. This is much narrower and is not tied to any increases or surcharges in companion legislation.
Okay. Any other questions? Say where?
Mr. Chairman, are you looking for a motion on the dash A2s?
Yes, please.
Then, Mr. Chairman, I would move the dash A2s to HGR 59.
Representative Williams moves the dash A2 amendments to HGR 59. Any more discussion? Any objection? They are adopted.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Williams.
I would move HGR 59 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Before I take the vote, is anybody going to be voting against this?
Yes.
Okay, Representative Rosenbaum. Okay, please call the roll.
Representative Corey?
Excused.
Representative Merkley?
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum?
No.
Representative
Representative Kennedy?
Excuse.
Representative Welch?
Aye.
Representative Williams?
Aye.
Representative Witt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Rasmussen?
Aye.
Chair Philbin?
Aye. HGR 59 moved to the floor of the Budapest recommendation. Same carriers as before. I want to thank everybody for working real hard to tighten this and make it something that's much more palatable. Thank you all very much. Oh, okay. Close the public seat. Close the work session. HGR 59. First off. Where did Representative Krasowski go? He was here just a second ago. Yeah.
Well, mostly might be in the hall room.
Well, that's okay. We're waiting for Jenny Walker for this other one.
Okay.
Maybe they were here and had somewhere else to go. Okay. Dick, what else do you have today?
I have the Aeronautics Bill 2199 and the Amusement Park 49.
Okay.
Let's
see what else we have. Why don't we open a public hearing on House Bill 2199, the aviation gas and jet fuel. Dick, can you tell us what this bill is?
Basically, Mr. Chair, the bill increases the aviation fuel tax rate, which is currently 3 cents per gallon. It increases it on the effective date of the act, which will be, as I understand it, the bill that's moving through the session, which would make the effective date for all bills January 1, will now affect the next session, not this session. So the effective date is probably October 1. And then, again, increases it by another 3 cents on July 1 of 2000. It also increases the tax on jet fuel, one increase of one-half of a penny. Currently the rate is a half a cent, it takes it to 1 cent. This money is to be used essentially by ODOT to pave areas which are used either as taxi areas or parking for airplanes.
Okay. We have Ann Crook from ODOT to testify. And the director.
Good morning. I am Ann Crook, the interim manager of the Aeronautics Division of the Oregon Department of Transportation. And with me, of course, is Grace Klinikin, the director of the Department of Transportation. Your staff has given you a good review of what the bill is all about. I wanted to talk a little bit this morning about why it's important. System of airports in the state is a very important, in fact, factor in supporting the economics and livability of the residents of the state of Oregon. Formerly timber-dependent communities are using their airports now to develop commercial and tourism industries. Farmers use their local airports to support quick and efficient movement of parts when their equipment is down and for crop dusting activities. And our airports support law enforcement operations, search and rescue, and forest fire spotting and support. And, of course, airports support an efficient transportation alternative all over the state, both intrastate and interstate and international. The state system of airports is made up of a diverse ownership by both the state, cities and counties, and ports, and a few privately owned public use airports out there. It's important to note that this system is funded solely by either local revenues or by aviation user fees statewide. There is no state general fund money that goes to support our airports. Our aviation fuel taxes, which is our main base to support our system, have not been increased since 1977. And so we have gone supporting our system for over 20 years with no increase in the funding. This increase is coming from jointly from all the users of the airport with airports, which is jet fuel and the aviation fuel taxes. And this program, as we've put it together, will provide an efficient and clear and a fair process for maintaining all of the pavements in the state. We've developed a program which analyzes the condition of all the pavements and then prioritizes which ones need the work, which airports are the most important, and we'll make sure that we spend the money on the priority projects. We've put this program together with the assistance of users all over the state, including the Port of Portland, Oregon Airport Managers Association, pilots and airport managers from big and small airports across the state, and this program has broad support from those who would be paying the fees. And in a nutshell, that's what the program is, and that's what it would do. Oregon Department of Transportation bringing those desires of the aviation users that want to pay the fees to support their own systems to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Krungen, you have anything else? Any questions? Tell us what the rates would be again, what they're proposed to go from.
The aviation gas tax is currently 3 cents. It would increase initially 3 cents and then increase again another 3 cents. So it would be a total of 9 cents per gallon. And jet fuel is currently a half cent. That would increase another half cent to a total of 1 cent per gallon.
And is this rate of increase something that you think is, you must think it's reasonable, but I've got a lot of letters and emails and things on both sides, and some of the people reference this, you know, the 100%, 200% increase as being too much.
Sure, Strobeck. the rates that we've come up with are a result of the efforts of this broad group that I talked about all working together. So while there are some who think that that increase in avgas is too high, there are others who think that the increase in jet fuel is too low. And yet we were all able to agree that this compromise was a good one.
Well, what's a gallon of aviation gas cost?
Just go back.
However you measure it.
In the ballpark of $2 per gallon.
And the tax is 3 cents. Oregon tax is 3 cents altogether.
Correct.
Can you go to self-serve and get it cheaper?
not currently.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I think that bill that was passed for the branch staff, that Eric Holt might be able to do that one.
We did.
Mr. Chairman, Representative William, I'm just interested as to why the department is taxing it based on the way that the airplane's landing on the runways. It was to be a joke.
Well, I kind of like the list of the prioritized projects.
Yeah.
That's unusual. Where'd you come up with that idea?
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry we missed the question.
I said, using a list of prioritized projects. That's a great idea, great concept.
Mr. Chairman, actually, Ann does have a list of the investments that are needed by airports, and so they know exactly where the money is going to go, as do the users that are paying the tax. Also, for the record, I think it would be good for us to say that a half cent of jet fuel tax earns about $900,000, and 3 cents of avgas earns about $150,000. So it's about $50,000 a penny that you earn off the avgas.
Okay. Other questions?
Mr. Chairman? Could you tell us what the current revenues are from these taxes per biennium?
The current revenues are a little over $1 million because, again, this would be basically a doubling in the first step with this proposal.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rich, that currently per biennium, the half cent yields $900,000 and the 3 cents yields $150,000. So we have about $1,050,000 per biennium from the existing tax. That would double, and then there'd be yet another, when the other three cents kicks in, there'll be yet another $150,000. So basically, with these increases, we increase just a little over twice the existing budget, which is about $1,050,000. And the only revenues that they have at the department are these revenues. There are other revenues that come from licenses, but that pretty much only covers the cost, the administrative cost. I don't know if you're speaking
to that. Mr. Chairman, follow.
Yes.
We're showing $1.9 million as the additional revenue in the coming biennium from this increase.
Yeah, Representative Strobeck, Representative Witt, I'm sorry, that was incorrect. This, the amounts that Director Cronican just talked about are per year, so that is double.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you.
Oh.
Or did you have something else to add?
That's all I have. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
We do have a list we could provide for the committee of the, literally the runways and what it would cost to do and where they're supposed to go. And these are runways that are the public use, the public runways are not just ODOT owned, but other cities and county, I mean, other public use airports around the state.
Mr. Chair?
Okay. Representative Shetterly.
Is Independence on the list?
Chair Strobeck, Representative Shetterly, absolutely.
Mm.
Roger.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin. I represent Alaska Airlines, and because Alaska Airlines is in charge of the state of Oregon and Washington and Alaska for the Air Transportation Association, I also represent them. I'm here to give you, I'd like to give you a little background so you clearly understand something about what this whole bill is about. I'm not here in absolute opposition. In fact, I'm not here in opposition, but I would like to clearly outline something, and I'd also like to tell you some heartburn that the airlines have about this. First of all, understand something. Representative Witt asked the question, there's about $1 million a year that comes in. $800,000 of that comes from the jet fuel. And you heard the figure that 3 cents raises another $150,000, 3 cents of the avgas. That's simply because there aren't enough private planes in Oregon. We don't use that much. The jet fuel income to the state of Oregon continues to go up, mainly because of the increase in airline traffic at PDX and the total of 7 commercial airports in the state of Oregon. But I would like for a moment to refer to something that you're very familiar with, the whole issue of cost responsibility. Whose responsibility is it to pay for the costs at airports in the state of Oregon? 95% of all the commercial air traffic is in the PDX, and I can assure you, and the Port of Portland can tell you, they are fully capable of extracting all the money they need from the airlines to pay for not only the runways, but the terminal expansions. Everything except the parking structure out of PDX is paid for by the various airlines through landing fees and other payments, not through the jet fuel. The Port of Portland could operate PDX without any further income whatsoever. So what we're talking about is the revenue to run the other airports of the state of Oregon. And I think we need to clearly understand that. And I'd like for a moment to use an example. All of you have been driving from where you live, many of us from the metropolitan area of Portland, to Salem. Where have you been refueling your automobile for the last 6 months?
Right
here. For the
last
5 months. Right here in Salem, because the price is lower. You have probably an 18-gallon tank like I do, so you pay attention to that. What if your tank was 5,000 gallons, and that's the size that airlines have, 5,000 gallons, and you have accountants and so forth, you would pay very astute attention to what the cost of fuel is. Now, on the raw basis, and you've probably seen this little map that's been produced by the proponents, that Oregon has the all-time low jet fuel tax in the nation. Well, we only show the western states, and it really doesn't matter what the jet fuel tax is in Idaho or Wyoming because planes don't fly out of there that come to PDX. They come from places like Colorado, Seattle, and Los Angeles. And you need to understand that in addition to the tax, the base cost of the fuel is very important. And what does Oregon not have that almost every other state in the nation has? An oil refinery. And I was a member of the legislature 25 years ago when this state last considered the possibility of allowing a refinery to be built here. And for better or for worse, the environmental community rose up in unison and screamed, we have no refinery and we never will have a refinery in the state of Oregon. Now that has resulted in us being at the end of the pipeline for the fuel you burn in your car and for jet fuel. And to get it here from the refineries in Washington and California, you have to pay a transportation cost. So the fact that on the raw form, it looks like Washington has a much higher jet fuel tax, the cost in, the last time I checked, the cost of jet fuel after all taxes, so just the base cost, and when you and I go into the service station, if it costs $1.29 a gallon, that's all we're thinking about. We're not breaking it all down. The cost in the state of Washington at SeaTac was 2.3 cents lower than it was at PDX because we have to transport the jet fuel, most of it comes out of the Puget Sound area, to PDX in order to put it in the planes. So when you start toying with this, we're not, a half a cent doesn't sound like very much at all. And I've told the airlines for the last 8 years that when the state of Oregon decides to increase transportation fuel taxes, expect that they will increase the jet fuel. But there are those, and it was mentioned by the director from the Air Nice Division, said that there are those in the state that think it's an unlimited opportunity. And I just want to plant that with everyone. It is not an unlimited opportunity because the first thing the airlines will start doing is tankering their fuel in here. Now, I've said that in a couple of meetings with air people, and they laugh at me because I think they have this vision that we're going to refuel, aerial refueling, tanker planes and so forth. I'm simply saying we'll fill up in Seattle and fly through here and fill up somewhere else. We'll bring our jet here. If you start raising the taxes much higher, then the airlines will simply respond as you would if you were running the business and buy your fuel somewhere else. So I caution you to be careful on that. Each time I get up and make these kind of comments, I irritate somebody in the air in the private airplane business, and invariably somebody calls Seattle and asks why Alaska Airlines why they have such a fool for a lobbyist. So to help people out, I will be happy to meet with anybody who wants to call, give them the name and the phone number of the chap in Seattle, because after I testified in the House Transportation Committee, somebody called Seattle and said, how come you have such an idiot representing you in Salem?
Answer, right?
Yeah. Usually, my folks in Seattle laugh and say, you must be doing something right if they're calling through up here to complain. Again, the airlines represented in the negotiations by the Port of Portland agreed that if this thing was handled and if we're seeing transportation costs go up, our transportation taxes go up across the board, we're not going to be able to stop this. But I want to make sure you understand there's a finite opportunity for us in Oregon to raise taxes from this. And you also have to understand that just as an example, the tax on avgas in the state of California, immediately to our south, is much higher, 18 cents a gallon. That's for the private pilots kind of fuel than it is here. So I just wanted to point those things out to you, Mr. Chairman. I would hope that you would keep in mind the thing that gives us the heartburn, and I want to point that out, because there's another piece of legislation going through, is to separate the Department of Aviation totally from the Department of Transportation. And I think you'll all understand if that happens, the board of the new separate aviation will be dominated by private pilots. They're the ones that pay the attention to the aviation division right now. And if you separate that and we're supplying the majority of the money, that's not something we look forward to, because you can easily see what will happen the next time that the smaller airports in Oregon have a problem. We'll just try to jack the jet fuel tax up. There's a balance that I hope we can maintain. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Roger. Any questions? Thanks. We'll look for that Seattle number. Keith Levin.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Keith Levitt with the Port of Portland. We're supportive of this project. I keep making the mistake of following Mr. Martin every time he testifies on this bill. We're supportive. This is an issue that with regard to the issues raised by the airlines over the years, we have had concerns with increase in the taxes, both on the avgas side and the jet fuel, but during the interim, a compromise was worked out. We think it's a reasonable one. So we're supportive of this. We think the pavement maintenance program envisioned by the use of the revenues from this tax is a worthy cause, one that we support as a system throughout the state for airports. And I'll just make it real brief and say we're supportive of this bill.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Thanks a lot, Keith.
Thanks.
Betsy Johnson.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I represent the Oregon Pilots Association. We're here in support of 2199, and I just wanted to add in response to Mr. Martin's comment that Senate Bill 108 that would create a Department of Aviation anticipates a gubernatorial appointment of the board. No one would have any control over who the board members were except the governor. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do we have anyone else on the list to testify? Is there anyone who wishes to testify on the bill who's not yet signed up? I think we've come to the moment of decision.
Okay. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2199. Open the work session on House Bill 2199. I know that the Transportation Committee spent a lot of time on this issue.
Yes, for sure.
Representative Rasmussen?
Mm-hmm. Are there any additional amendments to this bill?
No.
I'd like to move House Bill 2199-in gross to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Representative Rasmussen moves House Bill 2199-A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Revenue raising measure.
Right. 3/5 vote required on the floor.
Yes.
Okay. Please call the roll.
Representative Kapoor.
Excuse.
Representative Murphy.
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Representative Shetterly.
Aye.
Representative Welch.
Aye.
Representative Williams.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
No.
Vice Chair Rasmussen.
Aye.
Chris Gilbert.
Aye. House Bill 2199 will go to the floor with a due pass recommendation. We'll ask Representative Lehman to carry the bill since they spend a lot of time on it in transportation. Well, work session, House Bill 2199. Who wants to do that one last?
Yeah.
So now open the public hearing on House Bill 3606. Came to us from your committee, Representative Welch.
Yes, it is.
So tell us what it is, briefly.
Well, we have the proponents up here for this bill and save a little time.
Okay.
Let them start. Absolutely.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of this committee, my name is Jack Strajic. I represent Tulsa and Talbot. I'm supportive of House Bill 3606. Sitting to my right is the president of the company and partners of the writers of the meeting and the director of tax, Mr. Flannery, will be the president for Tulsa and Talbot.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mike Flannery. I'm the president and the chief operating officer of Hope and Talbot. Hope and Talbot is headquartered in Portland and is the oldest forest products company in the United States. We were founded in 1849 in Fort Gamble, Washington, and the company operates a pulp mill here in Halsey, Oregon, several sawmills in South Dakota and Wyoming, and in British Columbia. I'm here today in support of House Bill 3606. The bill would enable bleached craft pulp and paper mills in the state of Oregon to use a common method of financing that is known as the sale and leaseback method, and it's used as a way to finance construction, in this case, of a large-scale pollution control facility. In a sale and leaseback, a company actually sells a facility to an investor and then leases it back to operate the business. The current law already allows certain recycling facilities to use the sale and leaseback technique, and this bill would extend that treatment to bleached craft pulp and paper mills. The Halsey Pulp Mill was built in 1968 by the American Can Company, and it's the newest mill of its kind west of the Mississippi. Pulp and Talbot became a partner in the pulp mill in 1978 and became the sole owner in 1983. Our company paid a total of $38.5 million at the time to acquire the mill, and since then we've invested more than $40 million in pollution control equipment at that mill. As a result, the Halsey Mill is one of the most environmentally advanced mills in the world, and we have an excellent record of compliance with pollution control laws. But more than that, we're proud of our terrific record of working cooperatively with the federal and state environmental authorities and have a good record with them. In the mid-1990s, Pope and Talbot took the lead in gathering the financial and technical support for the Willamette River Study. Pollution control tax credits first came upon the scene in Oregon in 1967. It's passed by the legislature not only to encourage environmental pollution control expenditures in the states by existing businesses, but also to attract new industry to the state. These tax credits enabled companies to invest in environmental improvements by allowing them to recover 50% of their environmental expenditures over a period of 10 years through the reduction in taxes. Over the years, such credits have helped the high-tech industry, utilities, and many other manufacturers, and have brought and kept industry in the state. When pulp and paper mills earn taxable income, these credits are very helpful. Unfortunately, the EPA and other federal and state agencies may impose environmental requirements even during low points in the industry's business cycle. And the pulp and paper industry is now in such a downturn because of the unstable Asian economy and similar economic situations in Europe and South America. In addition, our industry must compete with pulp producers in other parts of the world that are not nearly as protective of the environment as we are here in the United States. In 1998, our company lost nearly $17 million at the Halsey Mill. And in fact, last year was the first time in its 30-year history that Halsey has experienced a temporary downtime of any consequence. We expect that a new upward phase of the business cycle is ahead, but in the meantime, we're unable to use the tax credits for pollution control facilities, and we face an EPA-mandated deadline for installing that equipment. This bill would help to level out the effects of the business cycle for the bleached kraft pulp and paper companies, because outside investors who pay to build pollution control facilities will be allowed to claim that credit. Those investors can use the credit and, in effect, pass the credit back to the companies in the form of a lower cost of funds. The intent of the original legislation is the same, and that is to lower the cost of installing the facility. The recently issued PLUS rules of the Environmental Protection Agency require that craft pulp mills, such as our Halsey plant, install new and additional pollution control equipment by 2001. Or face a federally mandated shutdown. In Pope and Talbot's case, the company must install $35 million worth of additional equipment in a mill that is already one of the most, if not the most, environmentally advanced plants of its kind. Installation of this equipment will bring to more than $75 million the amount of money we've invested in environmental control equipment in this one mill. This is almost twice the amount that we've paid for the original plant. The new pollution control equipment must be installed by 2001, or the EPA will not allow the mill to operate. And the jobs of more than 200 employees whose average wage, including benefits, is $74,000 a year, will be in jeopardy. In addition to those jobs, we estimate that 800 jobs that depend indirectly on the Halsey Mill will be lost throughout the state. Linn County would lose property taxes of more than $500,000 a year from the mill alone, and the state would lose $800,000 a year in income taxes paid by the employees. And property tax revenues would decline in Linn, Benton, and Lane County areas, workers left to find other jobs. All in all, we believe the Halsey Mill generates more tax revenues than the amount of the tax credits, and these are tax credits that we already would benefit from if the industry went out in a downturn. We strongly feel that the bill is revenue neutral to Oregon. It is possible that environmental groups or even the Oregon's Department of Environmental Quality might oppose this bill. We believe that they shouldn't. This is a bill that enables companies in Oregon to meet the mandate of the EPA during a worldwide depressed pulp market. It seems inconsistent with their mission of these groups to oppose regulations that would improve the environment. And it also seems inconsistent for the state agency to oppose regulations that seek to encourage its mission. Again, we believe the bill would be revenue neutral. The statute is not being extended, and this bill does not provide pollution tax credits beyond those available in the current statute. House Bill 3606 allows affected companies to contribute to continue to be environmentally responsible in a poor economy. Pope and Talbot and others in our industry have existed in this state for a long time, and we've grown with the state and have contributed to the welfare of Oregon citizens through the corporate participation, attractive wages, and by paying our share of taxes. Our property taxes and those of the employees have contributed to Oregon schools, and we believe this bill will help companies like ours to continue to contribute to Oregon's prosperity. We urge you to pass Bill 3606 to the floor of the House with a do-pass recommendation. I'd also like, that's my written statements, but I'd also like to add parenthetically a few more comments, if I may. First, these credits, in our view, exist for a reason, and that is to attract and retain industry in the state. The bleached pulp industry, and I speak particularly for Pope and Talbot's case, needs these credits considering that the regulations have been imposed upon it. Pope and Talbot will have spent more on pollution control equipment with no economic return than on the balance of the productive capacity of this mill. Our pulp mill is at best a low-return facility from an investment viewpoint, and it certainly is with great reluctance that P&T would make this investment even with the help of these credits. Without these credits, our board of directors will have a very difficult time agreeing to do this. Closure could follow with a very negative effect on the economic health of the region and a very large negative revenue impact on the state's income. This is shown by our response to the legislative review, revenue analysis, which does not take into account the dynamics of such an operation on the area involved. There are currently a number of facilities like Halsey in the south of the United States and in Maine, specifically Kimberly-Clark in Mobile, Alabama, and the Sappy Company's Westbrook, Maine facility, where their board of directors faced similar decisions but chose to close those pulp mills rather than invest in the required pollution control equipment. Oregon has recently suffered the loss of the International Paper Linerboard Mill in Gardner, Oregon, which reduced the market for sawmill chips in the region. Halsey plays a similar role for the local wood products industry purchasing their byproducts, and the ripple effect of a closure will affect them too. This financing alternative for Pope and Talbot is very important to this company, and we will have to borrow money to install this equipment, and the cost of those funds is very much affected by the outcome of this bill. We are a small company, and an investment of this nature and size is a critical one to us, and usually forecloses other opportunities that might exist for the use of these funds for the company. I thank you for the extended comment period that you provided me, and we'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Kleiner. Are there any questions?
Mr. Chair, I think most of us are not intimately familiar with the sale-leaseback strategy. I believe it has certain tax advantages. It's used for some of the buildings in downtown Portland. Can you just explain to us what the mechanics of why that's employed?
The funds are raised by basically selling the plant to a new owner, typically an investor, not necessarily somebody that wants to own the plant. The plant is in the case we see it, over either a 7 to 10 year period of time. The company buys the facility back, basically. And then at the end of that period of time, there's so you have very high payments, which are equivalent to depreciation and interest. And then at the end of that period of time, there's a stub amount that you buy the facility back. And when you do that, in this case, the investors reduce the interest cost that they charge you to reflect the value of these tax credits.
Okay. Mr. Chair, and I think part of the attraction for the investors is they then gain the depreciation value on the plant, and so we're transferring kind of that tax advantage to the investors.
That's correct, and by the same token, we end up paying depreciated non-cash costs. We pay the cash cost of that depreciation, so it ends up still used. Depreciation is still available for somebody. So.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much. Did you have something to offer, Finnegan? All right. Is anyone else here to speak on House Bill 3606? Seeing no one, I close the public hearing and open the work session, House Bill 3606.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. DeWitt?
I would move House Bill 3606 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Mr. DeWitt moves House Bill 3606 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Merkley?
I'm trying to find the revenue impact and see the fiscal impact.
Have you got a copy here? I have a
I think it was in our packet this morning.
Take a peek at that. This one.
You got it, Ed.
I have a hot full. You need one.
Okay. Do you want to... Did you want Ed to explain how he came up with that?
Mr. Chairman of the committee, it's admittedly a very rough estimate, but it's based on an idea of the transfer of credit from the current facility where it's the current ownership, where they've been unable to use it. in recent years to a group of a business that could potentially use it more effectively because they have offsetting tax liability. There also is an element of uncertainty in how many of these kinds of agreements might be able to be used by other companies in this industry to set up a similar sort of a lease buyback for the facility or for the tax credit. So it's admittedly rough. It's probably in the midpoint of the range of potential outcomes.
Mr. Chairman?
Rich St. Mercury didn't have any follow-ups. I wanted to also clarify whether the bill has a sunset in it as currently written, or it's actually extending the existing tax credits, I guess, that adopts.
It has a sunset. I'm not sure what.
It was one of the ones that we looked at when we went through the whole whole thing.
It's always had. It's always had a sunset.
Mm-hmm.
We continue to.
And these provisions have a carry forward as well.
Mm-hmm.
Say what? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ed, your revenue impact here, of course, is just an estimate based upon revenues that would not come in because of the application of the credit. There's no dynamic element to that in terms of what potential lost revenues might be there if plants are shut down, such as the plant down in Halsey. Isn't that correct?
Representative, that is correct.
Mr. Chair.
I represent Wells.
And what we certainly, we heard the same testimony and talked about this, a substantive portion of the bill and everything too. And I think what we should look at is the final page of Holton Tabak's testimony here and take a look at the number of jobs and what kind of a fiscal this develops for the state. When you look at those number of jobs and the property taxes paid, personal income taxes, corporate taxes, and the business, then you look at the somewhere around 3 to 3.85 additional jobs, the indirect connections, and then you extract those out, extrapolate those out, and I tell you what, it's we can't take care of our in-state and domestic industry, and if someone else, other industry, wants to use this provision, I think we can still be a winner in this state with this provision moving forward, and it'll way offset any assumptions, I think, at this point in time that we might lose some revenue.
Okay, further discussion. Representative Webb.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think we're not debating here is the use of pollution control tax credits. What we're saying is given the current policy, current law that we have on pollution control tax credits, is the sale leaseback method of capital assets a legitimate way in which you should be able to use that credit? I think the answer to that is yes. Sale and leaseback is common in terms of financing assets. I think in this case, it is a logical part of the program when it comes to pollution control tax credits that would continue to apply in this type of situation. And also I'm persuaded here that this is a business, Tobin Talbot, has been an Oregon corporation for 150 years. They've been an excellent employer in Oregon. I think to deny them the use of the credit to a sale leaseback, I think, would be bad public policy. And I think it's a good bill, and I'm happy to support it.
Hey, anybody else? Please call the roll. Excuse?
Representative Murphy.
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Representative Federley.
Aye.
Representative Wells.
Aye.
Representative Wright.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Mr. Rasmussen.
Aye.
Mr. Gilbert. Aye. House Bill 3606 is moved to the floor of the due pass recommendation. If you have would you carry it?
I would be more than happy to.
Okay. Thank you all for coming. Close the work session on House Bill 3606. Open public hearing on House Bill 2817. Representatives Walker and Kozanski.
Go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. Floyd Pizanski, House District 40. And joining me today is Vicki Walker, representative from House District 41.
Good morning.
We are here today with a bill that was actually in the Soil Health and Water and Environment. Chair and committee member, Representative Welsh, referred it here because there is going to be a need for this committee to determine a policy as to a tax credit proposal that has been made. I understand that you have received a revenue impact statement, which is contrary to what the intent of the bill is going to be amended into. And so we want to dispel any alarm that you may have when you look at that, because the revenue impact that you have includes the actual removal of the tank from the ground. We have dash three amendments, which I believe have already been distributed to you, and in talking with the good chair from Water and Environment, and our own consideration is that we, and as well as the individual who was one of the proponents for the legislation coming forward, Robert Bustain, is that we think it should be limited to tax credit on the basis of picking up and disposing of contaminated waste that's caused from a tank that has leaked, as compared to the actual removal of the tank. The other part that is, I think, really important to put forward is when you look at the A and Gross bill, it does, in fact, show what the tax credit would be on a prorated basis. We believe this is appropriate because what we're attempting to do is remove not only the ground tank but also the contamination that can result from a leaky tank, and make certain individuals who are most needy of having financial assistance receive that opportunity to get that. When you look through lines 17 through 26 on the first page of the bill, you can see what the breakdown would be based on the federal adjusted gross income and then what the percentage would be that could be recovered. It has also come to our attention that we would like to make one other proposed amendment to the bill, and that is if you look on page 2 of the bill, lines 13 through 19, it provides for any tax credit that would be permissible to a taxpayer under this bill would be able to carry over that credit for up to 14 years. We realize that that is a significant length of time, and we will be asking this committee to have an opportunity to have an amendment that would cap it or limit that to 5 years. We feel that that would be appropriate, and what we're going to do is go over the testimony, but we wanted to, let's say, dispel some of the concerns that we understand that some of the members have with the bill in its current form. So with that in mind, we would like to just briefly explain to you why we believe this is appropriate legislation and a policy that should be adopted this session. And in doing so, I believe now you have received a copy of the letter from Robert Despain from State & Company regarding his concerns as to being a person that's on the job site and seeing what is happening and the need for this type of legislation. With that in mind, if we could go forward, what we would like to do is, I guess, give members who are new to the process a little bit more understanding as to and recognition of how big of a problem we really do have when you're dealing with contaminated soil, as well as the need to have these tanks removed. It's our understanding from my research, and I believe that there's somewhere in the range of 5,300 leaky home heating oil tanks that have been reported over the last 10 years, and with more than 1,100 that have been reported in just the last year alone. This, and I want to make certain that you understand when I give you those figures, those are for leaky tanks. That is not for the number of tanks that need to be removed that are not leaking, but because of the Dash 3 amendments we'll be addressing that, we wanted to start off with that. As everyone can pretty well recognize and I guess are familiar, there's been a shift in our philosophy in the Northwest, and a lot of people who have had home heating oil tanks on their property that they are shifting to other type of home heating means. Most of it, from my understanding, are either going to natural gas or going to electric, but that does not deal with the problems that we have on site of having still in on real property the potential, if not outright, contamination occurring throughout this the state. in various aspects. The vast majority of these are in the Willamette Valley corridor or region, and we feel that these are areas that we need to be addressing. So the bottom line of what the bill is going to, is proposing to do is, in fact, to provide an incentive for individuals to take the steps that are necessary to remove home heating oil tanks, and if in doing so they determine that there is contamination on site, that they would be able to actually complete the project without having complete devastation to their property as well as to their pocketbook. That's kind of an overview of what we're wanting to accomplish, and I do want to give you one bit of historical perspective. Senator Shields has been an individual advocate for this process for some time. I came into the legislature in 1995, and if memory serves me correctly, he was putting a challenge out to the body in 95 as well as in 1997 to address the overall concerns of just removal of the tanks. And now that we have it been clearly demonstrated that the financial hardship that can occur from an individual trying to do the right thing, we feel that having a modified, limited approach to deal with the contamination that could occur from the removal of tanks, that this would in fact help all of Oregon to get rid of the potential and the actual existing problems that are there underground today. You may ask, why is this important, groundwater? The bottom line is the more time we wait, the more time that passes, the more likelihood that we're going to see serious contamination in larger metropolitan areas as well as in smaller areas that have in the past 20 to 40 years relied on home heating oil with tanks that have been submerged or have been buried into the ground. So that is kind of an overview, and I guess the other thing I would want to say before Representative Walker gives you some other facts and data is that we've addressed this issue on the federal level as it pertains to gasoline dealers having a duty and a need to basically revamp their stations and come in compliance with those federal rules. Robert Despain, who is the author of the letter that she received, is an individual I know personally, and we've had two or three conversations about the potential impact that we're going to see if we don't get up on top of this, not only for the environment, but also having some federal mandates that may be coming. So I believe it's an opportunity for Oregon to really step forward and be one of the leaders in the nation of putting in a program that would, in fact, help address these serious concerns.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Walker from House District 41, I really want to thank you for having this hearing. I know I've been after you for a while to share this bill, and it's really important to the state of Oregon, and Representative Welch has heard our story in front of his committee. This, as Representative Levansky talked about, you know, there are 150,000 abandoned heating oil tanks in Oregon. We don't know to what extent they're leaking or not. And I was relatively unaware of this problem until last summer when I was out canvassing one of my neighborhoods on the campaign trail and came across this front yard that was all torn up and there was a lot of soil sitting around, and I asked the folks what was going on, and they had a leaky underground storage tank. These people have incurred significant costs, $14,000 to date, because their soil soil was contaminated, the groundwater was contaminated. It's a significant issue for them. Once the groundwater became contaminated, their homeowner's insurance kicked in, but not until significant sums of money were expended from their own pocket. Robert Despain's letter will tell you that the average cost of a simple soil cleanup and decommissioning is about $1,000 to $3,000, but certainly any further contamination can range from $8,000 to $15,000, as I've just indicated. I think the tax credit is really important. As you know, the oil, some of you may know this, some of you may not, the Oil Heat Commission was originally enacted to help offset costs for homeowners. Monies were collected by implementing an oil heat tax on oil marketers. Well, they didn't really like that idea. The commission didn't do its job, and just this session, a few days ago or whenever recently, we had so many bills, we voted out of this body to eliminate that statute. So the Oil and Heat Commission, if it passes through the Senate and the governor signs it, will no longer exist. So we do need to provide homeowners with some assistance here. This is a deal breaker for many, many homes across the state. Mortgage lenders are finding this, and real estate brokers are finding this to be a significant impact. Robert Despain's letter on page 2 can tell you the numbers of leaking tanks that DEQ has reported, and they're just growing significantly. So I think we've made some concessions on this bill to try to make the revenue impact less significant, but I really would appreciate your assistance in this matter and adopt the dash 3s, and we'll propose an additional one to limit the credit to 5 years if you like.
Mr. Chair, if I could follow up on a couple of the points. There is a set of dash 2s that have been presented to the committee for your consideration. We're not here to support or to object to them. We just want to let you know that they are there. What the effect of the dash 2s would be, require the people who are removing and doing the cleanup to be certified to do that process. Representative Welsh and myself spoke about that, and I know that he had some concerns at one point of the cost that people are incurred, and considering and figuring that maybe some of these individuals, because of it's a limited pool that are now able to do the cleanup, maybe causing the cost to increase. I think this is a policy decision that this committee can make the decision whether that's necessary. It seems appropriate to me. I will say that if an individual goes through DEQ, they are going to have to be certified by DEQ to be clean, that is appropriately cleaned and tested. And so I think that's it's an issue that can go either way. So what we would ask the chair at this time and the committee to consider is if this committee is not shutting down in the next 24 to 48 hours, to one, allow us to bring back the new additional amendment for your consideration with the 5-year cap. We would ask you to support the bill today with the dash 3 being put into it. That way we would be able to get the new revenue impact, so you would have a clearer picture as to what the actual policy decision would be as to how great the potential would be. And if the committee is in fact in the process of closing down, then we would ask the committee to allow the bill to, let's say, retain some life and move it to Ways and Means, and at that point we may be able to bring it. But we think that this committee would be our first option, since you are the ones who have been dealing with tax credits throughout this session.
Thank you, Representative Kozakian. I have a couple of questions. Now, the amendments made in the Water and Environment Committee still talked about the cost, 100% of cost incurred in removing the tank, and that didn't talk about just the leaking portion.
That is correct, and that was the problem. What happened is we had three sets of amendments that came in. The dash ones were adopted by Water Environment. Unfortunately, the dash ones were not drafted the way we wanted them to be originally drafted, and that's why we bought the dash threes that would, in fact, take out the intent of the dash threes is to remove basically lines 9 and 10 on page 1, mm-hmm. which would be allowing for any type of tax credit for just the removal of the tank from underground.
Okay. Well, we have amendments here, dash 2, well, the dash 3 and the dash 2 refer to the original bill, but we have a engrossed version of the bill.
That's right. They were all drafted mm-hmm. at the same time, and that was the problem, because when I looked at it before, I had the same concern, because I thought the dash 3 should actually make reference to the A and gross.
Right.
It's my understanding from Representative Walker's, her office is the one that coordinated with LC, that those were drafted at or similar at the same time prior to the A and gross being adopted.
So this committee can have the choice of either pursuing the A and gross bill or amending the original bill. Is that your understanding?
You could do that, because we have dash 1 amendments from the original bill
We don't want to do the dash one,
no.
Right?
Okay.
The dash one. So we have an engrossed bill.
Oh,
normally
could,
what we would
right,
work
right.
On our, by reference
right.
By the committee.
Right.
So my concern is whether the amendments don't amend the engrossed bill.
Right.
So they amend the original bill, so we would have to just ignore the engrossed version, deal only with the original printed bill.
Mr. Chair, I think that's correct, but let me maybe make this suggestion, if the committee would be willing to do this. We could work off the engrossed and just delete those two lines, which is what the dash three is intended to do. I'm not sure procedural-wise if that would get us to the point of where we could then have the revenue statement prepared.
Well, I think what the deal is, I don't want to get into a problem of adopting the wrong amendments into a previous version of the bill. I've asked Ed to take a look at the dash threes and prepare a revenue statement off of those, which he can do
okay.
Next time this comes up. What I would request of you is to take the dash threes and the dash twos and your suggestion for changing 14 to 5, have that, maybe not the dash two since you weren't the author of those, but have the dash threes and the dash have the dash three then the 5-year carry forward instead of 14 years drafted into a new amendment
for the engrossed,
which we can consider for the A engrossed as well as have this dash two redrafted to
okay.
Amend the A engrossed.
Okay.
All right. The dash two will have amended separately.
Yes, it's for all three of them separately.
Okay. Great.
Or I guess I think you could put the 5-year and the dash three together.
Right.
And then we'll have one other amendment that deals with the DEQ
okay.
Certification.
We have to do that. And I apologize for that. We didn't realize that we had these drafted after that bill was passed and became the engrossed.
Yeah. Okay. All right, we'll do that.
Mr. Chair, I have several questions. So I guess my first question is in regard to the dash three and to clarify why that will reduce cost significantly. The tanks I've been familiar with when there's a leak, the tank has always been removed in order to get at the contaminated soil below the tank. So how does limiting it just to cleaning up the soil reduce the cost?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, the way it will reduce it is there's a vast number of tanks that are not leaking. And if you have the credit in place for just the actual removal of the tank, you will then at that point end up with the revenue statement that you had before you, which I believe is over $4 million. If you limit it to where the tank is removed and then there is contamination of the soil found, the tax credit would be for just the removal of the contaminated soil. And as Robert Despain has mentioned, it actually, the cost can range from maybe one dump truck full of soil that needs to be replaced and taken out to a very significant problem that, as he's documented, somewhere in the range of $15,000 for one cleanup. Our thought, and based on his experience and expertise, by limiting it to just the contaminated soil where, on a policy-wise discussion, we're all shifting or wanting to shift to remove these type of hazards from the ground. And people who have them, and we have one at our house, we should incur the cost of removing the tank itself. But where the concern and the financial hardship really impacts someone is if they do end up with contaminated soil, that they would need to have that unforeseen cost covered on an individual basis.
I think I have a couple other questions on
that. Could you hold your questions actually until we get this back with the final amendment?
No, my concern was that it might make an impact on the final amendments, but I'll be glad to
offer the party. If you have something specific that would impact the drafting of the amendments, go ahead.
Well, rather than take the committee's time, why don't I meet with the parties separately to raise my concerns?
That would be good. Okay. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
You're welcome. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2817. Open a work session on Senate Bill 2.
question?
Let me grab the folder here, Representative. You're ahead of me.
Okay. Ed is leaving. Ed just passed out a letter from Director, or from Bob, Doug Wilson, finance person in DHR. Or actually, we should call it DHS now since we've changed the name of it. Nobody will ever remember that. The reason why we got this?
Well, it was provided to me by a person who came to speak to the bill yesterday.
And they
suggested that the committee get it.
All right. Okay. Do you have anything else to add?
No, just care to add that I had worked on the Dash 2 amendments that were distributed last time.
Mm-hmm.
And you should have that revenue impact statement, I believe.
Yep.
And as we discussed last time, regarding the Dash 1 amendment, the revenue impact statement for House Bill 3450-2, which was distributed last time, applies to that portion of the bill.
Okay. We are in work session. Representative Rosenbaum?
I move the Dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 2.
Representative Rosenbaum moves the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 2. Discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
We got those last time. The revenue impact you just got today in your stack of papers today. Yeah. This is what it is.
I'm not having a little problem with this to find my revenue.
Yes.
This one dated 5/20?
That's correct.
Yes.
52-2.
Ed, why is it the original revenue impact of SB 2 had a $15 million impact, but if you make it refundable, it goes to $12 million? It seems like it ought to go the other way.
Mr. Chair, I mean, the original bill expands the income limit for filers who could qualify and apply for the Working Family Child Care Credit, and really gets a range of filers who have taxable income and could start using the tax credit. The Dash 2 amendments do not expand the income limits. They keep the limits that were originally in the bill that was passed by the commission, and make it refundable. So this represents the incremental cost of making the existing credit refundable. The total cost of the credit, including the existing portion and this, is on the order of $24 million for my annual. This represents the Senate Bill 2-2. The impact statement represents the incremental cost of making the Working Family Child Care Credit refundable.
Mr. Chair? Just to maybe explain this a little bit further, I think the problem we're facing is this when we keep coming back to this, it's not enough resources to do everything we would ideally like to do. And the intent of these amendments is to take the existing credit and make it more meaningful to people at the lower end of the income scale. The problem faced by people that are working recently, getting off welfare jobs that are typically making $7.50 an hour, is that they're getting very little benefit from this because tax liability isn't high enough to take advantage of it. And so the intent is to help those people who are making the least money or still having to pay the same cost in child care, making somewhat more. Ideally, we would do both, but I don't think that's going to be possible. And I think the policy choice to make is here to apply the help. I think it would be unfortunate to continue having people making minimum wage that are getting virtually nothing and still having to pay their child care expenses.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Merkley.
Refer the committee back to a chart we had presented in former testimony that looked very artsy. And essentially, what it showed is that at the lower income range, 650, 750, a 16th to an 8th of the potential tax credit was being utilized because people's taxable income was simply not large enough. So you have this interesting situation where those most in need of the credit are unable to avail themselves of it. I think SB 2-2 makes the right adjustment to target the funds where needed most and is consistent with the original census of the credit.
Okay, other discussion on the dash twos? Please call the roll. Excuse.
Representative Merkley.
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Representative Federley.
Aye.
Representative Welch.
No.
Representative Williams.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Vice Chair Rasmussen.
Aye.
Chair Skolbeck.
No. Dash 2s are adopted.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Witt.
I move the dash 1 amendments to House Bill, Senate Bill 2.
Representative Witt moves the dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 2. This is the provision that allows the stay-at-home spouse to essentially the same as House Bill 3450, which you heard earlier.
And Mr. Chairman, I think so what Senate Bill 2 does, and I think what it does effectively with the amendments we just adopted, is it allows it provides real needed support for child care for low-income workers, wage earners. And I think it recognizes what is a legitimate need. But we also have the situation where a parent leaves the workforce instead of getting child care to stay at home to care for his or her child. And I think what the Dash 1 amendments do is they provide some needed relief for parents who make that decision or families who make that decision that frankly helps balance this policy relative to child care. So I think the Dash 1 amendments are frankly consistent with the Dash 2 amendments in terms of providing some balanced policy to this issue of child care for low-income wage earners.
Further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
I'll not be supporting the Dash 1 amendments. I think the Dash 2 amendments are technically good. They work well. And they have a remarkable revenue impact in themselves. To add the Dash 1 amendments, I think just frankly are not technically as sound as the Dash 2 amendments. I think kind of some odd and difficult to work qualification criteria, and then plus the additional $13 million revenue impact. I think that if we're going in this direction, the Dash 2 amendments make a solid policy statement and get us to where we're providing assistance to the people who need it. I'm not sure that the Dash 1 amendments are as well focused or are as technically sound. I'll not be supporting them.
There were concerns about the language in 3450. These amendments are based on changes that were designed to address those technical issues that you referenced. Further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Merkley.
I think it's interesting to observe that much of our public policy has been about the last few years getting single mothers who are at home with their children out and into the workforce, and now we're turning around and saying those families fortunate enough to have two parents, we'd like to try to get a parent out of the workforce and back in the home. My specific concern in this in dash one is in lines 12 through 14, the non-working spouse must have been employed previously and choose to leave following enactment of this bill, and yet we have many families that have already made this choice. And as drafted, I don't have an easy fix to this, we create a fundamentally unfair situation between identical families who have made identical choices receiving very different tax benefits. And I think that's I don't know where else in the law we've done that. We've tried to be very careful to treat people who are making the same choices for the same reasons and giving them the same tax benefits. And as drafted, we don't achieve that in this bill, in this dash one.
Well, I just observed that every time we change a policy, we, except for the rare occasions when we do put retroactive clauses in, we change it for that date forward or the effective date of the act forward, and that's just a simple fact of the progress of time. I'd also observe that your comment about we've been focused on trying to get single mothers into the workforce, I'd say that in fact, we've been almost exclusively focused on that and have not acknowledged that there's equal or better value of having families intact and having caregivers at home with the kids rather than always having to say that that people must into the workforce and put their children in daycare or child care of some sort. I think this is a statement that says there's value in both environments for children, and it honors that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chairman, I think what we're trying to do is we're trying to adopt policy here that allows parents to make the choice that they think is right for their children. And if in a situation where there's two parents, they're both going to work, what we're doing for low-income families is we're acknowledging that this is a difficult situation. We're providing them some tax relief, and in this case, a refundable tax credit for child care. I think that's a good and fair policy consideration. But we also have parents who want to make the choice for one of the parents to stay home and provide the care at home to the child. And I think what the dash ones do is to provide that balance. We're providing parents with a choice. We're not making a decision. Do we want to force parents into the workforce when they have young children, or do we want them to stay at home? What we're doing is we're giving them a fair choice here and tax relief under either situation. I was pleased to support the dash twos. I do not understand why some people in this committee who support the dash twos won't support the dash ones. And when you talk about the revenue impact from the dash twos was significantly higher than the dash ones. This is about balanced policy for low-income people with children.
Okay, any further discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Sikori.
Let's get Representative Sherry in the room. For that one. Corey's excused.
No.
Representative Rosenbaum.
No.
Representative Shetterly.
No.
Representative Shell.
Yes.
Representative Williams.
Yes.
Representative Witt.
Yes.
Vice Chair Rasmussen.
No.
Chair Strobeck.
Yes. The dash ones are not adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rasmussen.
I move Senate Bill 2 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Rasmussen moves Senate Bill 2 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Witt.
I wanted to support this bill, but I can't now. It's advocating an unbalanced policy when it comes to low-income parents in terms of caring for the children. Frankly, I'm very, very disturbed that we couldn't also adopt the Dash 1.
Other discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rosenblatt.
I would just say that I think the bill, as it exists now, doesn't do everything we would like it to do, but it does continue a policy that's in the law now that makes it more meaningful to the people it's set out to help us, especially, and I would hope it would still move forward.
Anything else? I would observe that I actually share Representative Witt's comments, and I don't care for the refundable principle, although I understand the issue behind it. I just still think that it's a bad public policy to say we're essentially going to give everybody an income floor, and you know, I value those people who are working their way up out of the depth of poverty, but at the same time, I think that we need to send a message that there's responsibilities at all levels of income in society, and that as you increase in your income and then the benefits provided by this credit increase, but what we're doing is establishing a floor, so I'm not sure I'll be supporting this bill on the floor.
I can't support it at this point in time either. And we're changing some policy here that I think Oregon has gotten real tough on welfare reform, and this kind of reverses that. It doesn't kind of. It does. I don't think the taxpayers can be responsible for those who have children and expect that we can take care of child care continuously through this compared to those who are working in poverty levels who don't have children also. I think the challenges and the problems exist. They're the same here. But this takes us backwards in our efforts, I believe, and all the other programs that we have tried to get people working in this state. And so I certainly cannot, working or going to school, whatever program we see. And we have plenty of those helping today. But this counters, I think, what we've been trying to do and establishes once again, a welfare program, as you can see, in the millions of dollars in the revenue impact here. And I think that's exactly how it should be stated. I'm not going to beat around the bush on that. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Hey, what?
Not to belabor the point, I want my vote to be clearly understood. I do not have a problem with supporting a refundable tax credit for low-income families with children. In fact, I think it's sound public policy to the extent these parents are working, trying to make their way. I do not mind supporting the use of tax dollars for those purposes. But I do mind an unbalanced policy when it comes to this that favors low-income parents going out into the workforce and penalizes them for making the decision to stay at home with their children. And for that reason, I'm going to vote against the bill.
Please call the roll.
Senator Murphy.
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum. Aye. Representative Shetterly.
Aye.
Representative Rowe.
No.
Representative Witt.
No.
Mr. Rasmussen.
Aye.
Mr. Scobit.
No.
And the bill, too, moves before the due
pass
recommendation.
Mr. Chair. Oh, it does?
Yes.
We had enough votes.
Yes, we had the votes.
Oh, we're one short.
You want to redo it and change your vote?
I wanted to see if I needed to change my vote to move for reconsideration. But
no,
thank you.
Who would like to be a carrier?
Representative Rosenbaum might carry
the bill. Want to carry the bill? Representative Rosenbaum will carry the bill. Close the session on Senate Bill 2. Let's see. Are you done? Okay, thank you very much. Yeah, I believe
okay.
Okay, we need to open a work session on Senate Bill or House Bill 2248. Last time we had this bill before us, Representative Witt offered a conceptual amendment to the bill, and on advice of legislative counsel, they felt like that was too vague a conceptual amendment. As we basically just said, well, we didn't know quite how to word it on the fly in the committee. So what we have before us is the -810 amendment, which actually puts into legal terms the conceptual amendment that was offered. So what we need to do is to move for suspension of the rules. Anybody object to suspending the rules? And the chair would move that we reconsider the vote by which we passed House Bill 2248. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. So we have the bill before us again.
You're right.
Okay. What else do you have here?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, with House Bill 2248, the amendment you have before you tries to put the ideas that we were talking about how you're going to allocate this first 30% of the $1 million of corporate income and excise taxes paid by the corporation that is given a long-term investment credit. Now, the main issue is if you look on subsection of 10, the subsection C, line 15, where we're talking about the county treasurer and shall distribute the monies allocated to the code area. So they're first distributing the money to the code area of the facility, where the facility is located, to the code area according to the taxing districts that are located in that code area based on their billing rate. So they look at their billing rates percent of the total billing rate in the code area. And then the county treasurer shall distribute the monies according to that distribution. Now, the issue is whether or not you should be considering just the taxing districts within the code area of where the facility is located, or if you should also be incorporating in the sponsor's billing operating tax rate also, the sponsor of the enterprise zone. So that's what has caused a little bit of question now with the -810, is whether or not you're just looking at the taxing districts that are in the code area that are losing the property tax revenues when you give this property tax exemption, or if in addition to those taxing districts, you should also consider the sponsor of the enterprise zone, which may not be located within the code area where the facility is actually located. So that's the question before you. So I have additional language if you want to add in the sponsor, in addition to the taxing districts in the code area, their billing rate would also be incorporated into the billing rate.
Excuse me. Does everybody have a copy of the HM?
Yes.
Yes?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, we have.
Okay. Sorry, all right. So are there questions on that, on what kind of the issue is in this sub? It's mainly 10 in the subsection C, line 15, whether or not you want to be incorporating in there the sponsor's billing rate as a portion of the total or not. That is, as it is written, you're just going to be giving back 30% of the first $1 million to the taxing districts, which actually impose a tax in the code area of the facility.
Can anybody help us decide if this is great policy or bad policy? Anybody have an opinion?
There's opinion.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Christina Squires representing the Special Districts Association. It really is a policy issue that Lizbeth is bringing up here. I think Representative Witt's amendment was, and correct me if I'm wrong, Representative Witt, intended to address property tax revenue that was taken off of the rolls for the sponsor for, when an enterprise zone was created, and some of those property tax revenues were special district property tax revenues who do not create those zones, and the 30% of the first $1 million would then be allocated back to anybody who lost property tax revenues by creating the enterprise zone. There's a little bit of a discrepancy about whether or not it should go back to other people who didn't actually lose any property tax revenue, and I think the intent of this amendment was to only give back money to those who lost property tax revenues.
Sure.
Representative Shetterly.
That's the intent. Is that what it does?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shetterly, A-10 does do that.
Anybody else?
Nothing to add to that, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Lynn McNamara from the League of Oregon Cities. We are in support of the concept of the A-10, kind of an unqualified maybe, on this issue, partly because this apparently went into effect in 1997 when this originally was set up, and I think the Economic Development Department would have to tell you what the intent was in, and we're talking about $300,000 here, so we're not talking about a huge amount of money to compensate lost property tax revenue. I think that is the issue to the extent that the sponsors of the enterprise zone, which may or may not be the tax code area, was involved in this in the first place. That was the intent of providing some incentive from that 30% of the first $1 million. And again, I can't tell you exactly what happened and why in 97, but that was the difference. It wasn't just to compensate for lost property tax revenue. But in terms of the concept of sharing that money with the other taxing districts, if we were in their position, we would say the same thing. So.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Fish. Do you have something to add? Members were excused. I'd appreciate it if you stay with me. We've got one more bill to deal with after that.
Chairman Strobeck, members of the committee, my name is Arthur Fish with the Oregon Economic Development Department. I apologize for the other day because there are some implications here that are coming up that I probably could have alluded to or thought of the other day when this concept was first arose. But, you know, there are two. One, a sponsor, as it's still stated in the law and would still be stated in the law here, means a collectivity of maybe a county plus maybe one, two, or three cities. All right, and that's the way it was stated, and that's the way the Attorney General made quite clear that reference would refer to those group of jurisdictions. So there are already groups of cities that are sort of looking at this distribution as part of some projects that you may have heard about that are sort of out there. Secondly, this distribution of 30% of the excise taxes that a long-term qualified facility would pay under this particular thing that was created in 1997, it only happens if the governor, in fact, also approves the credits. Otherwise, the company might get a property tax exemption, but there would be no excise tax credits without the governor's approval and no 30% distribution. So as a quid pro quo for property taxes that might have been paid by the facility otherwise, I don't think it was quite intended for that specifically. It was also intended, I think, to motivate and bring some interesting aspects to the discussions between the local governments, the company proposing the facility, and the governor's office, indeed. And what you have here that I noticed in looking at this A-10 this morning was that the sponsor would still be there, and it would say the sponsor and other taxing districts. And that's I think that's a fine way to, you know, go on the policy as set by the 1997 legislature. But when you go down below to the actual mechanics for the county treasurer to follow there in subsection C of what would become section 10, there's no indication of the sponsor. And so I kind of view the need for these clarifying languages as more of a technical matter to clarify the fact that you still have the sponsor indicated as a recipient of the 30% distribution, which, you know, is interpreted to mean the various cities and the county, but no clarity about how that distribution would accrue to them. So this would clarify that those cities, and the facility might be outside of any city's incorporated limits that sponsors the enterprise zone, that they get added into the sort of overall total of billing rates that are then divided or apportioned out to determine who gets what as far as what distribution there is. And it may be $300,000, it may be something less per year. And then it would also clarify there in subsection E that because of the equalization that's going on, that school districts of all types would be netted out.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
Thank you. It's the committee's pleasure on A-10 as written.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Witt.
I would move the -10 amendments to the bill.
Okay, move -810 amendments for the discussion.
Can I just ask,
yeah.
Representative Witt,
One thing that might help at least in clarifying the A10 is we did a conceptual amendment as far as defining school district and then just inserting educational service district or community colleges to not be considered above in the tax district. So that's not, I don't think, controversial out there, but just the other section.
Are you okay with that, Representative?
No, that's fine, Mr. Chairman.
So the suggestion is to conceptually amend the -H10 amendment on line 22 following the word district to add in education service district or community college.
We require suspension of the rules.
Oh, yes, suspend the rules. Anybody object? So ordered. Conceptual amendment is offered. Any objections? Adopted. I think there are some, there are concerns with this, with the rest of this language about the sponsor and all. We can suggest that you write that up, follow it up on the Senate side, the House bill. We need to get it out of here. Any more discussion on the motion to adopt the -10? Is it okay with Paul? Anyone? Okay. Any objection? Ordered. And let's say what?
Chairman, I would move House Bill 2248 as amended.
Representative Witt moves House Bill 2248 as amended to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Any more discussion? Any objection? Or the same carrier as last time? The motion is adopted. And close the work session on House Bill 2248. Open the work session on House Bill 2375. We have the -3. Would you tell us about this?
Yeah. Basically, with the -3, it's deleting the current bill, and as we talked about in the previous public hearing, it's just canceling the additional tax that is resulting from disqualification of specially assessed forest land if the sale or transfer of the property is to a federal, state, or local government agency, and also classifying that a lien of the taxes and interest shall not attach if there's a declassification of forest land as a result of forest land being acquired by a federal, state, or local agency. And then finally, there shall not be additional tax and lien of taxes and interest if there's a disqualification of land that's designated as forest land as a result of an application being filed from the forest land being acquired by a government agency. So this will all take effect on or after January 1st of 2000. There's no significant revenue impact from this measure. Basically, the amount of taxes that are really going to be resulting from this disqualification would be very minimal.
Okay, and it only applies if
Your forest land is being transferred to an exempt entity.
In other words, if it's going to
government agency.
Agency. Okay. Chair moves House Bill 2375.
You need the
Chair moves the -3 amendments House Bill 2375. Any discussion? Any objection? Ordered.
Chairman.
Representative Williams.
I move House Bill 2375 as amended to the floor with a due process recommendation.
Representative Williams moves House Bill 2375 as amended to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Please show members not here as excused. Motion is adopted. Representative Williams, would you like to
carry? Yes, I'll carry.
Thank you. Representative Williams will be the carrier. Court work session on House Bill 2375. We're not going to do Senate Bill 249 today. Remember, we have Monday off. We'll see you at 2 in the morning at 8:15.
Thanks for doing it for
the off. Sure. For June.
Are you going on another trip?
No.
Just came off.
We're running.